So it is 5 o'clock, and as always at 5 o'clock on Tuesday, we welcome you to Office Hour. You're listening to 90.3 KDVS, and I want to remind you that the views that are presented in the show do not reflect the views of KDVS, the KDVS sponsors, or the University of California. So this is Professor J, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz, and every Tuesday at 5, we go out knocking on doors. So can you hear me? There I'm knocking. I'm knocking on a door today, and I'm very pleased. It's finals week, and I think everybody, you can just feel, moving into finals week, this is actually the last week of classes, you can just feel the anxiety level rising around campus. So we're going to kind of bring it down a little bit by talking about poetry today, which is just so everybody should just relax into some poetry and literature. And I'm very happy to welcome Robert Newcomb from the Spanish and Portuguese department, who has brought some of his own translations. So these are translations you wouldn't hear anyplace else. So welcome to the show, Robert.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me. I'm a fan of the show, so it's nice to be on.
Yeah. So, we're going to be talking about some terms that actually some of our listeners may never heard of, Iberian literature from Gibraltar. I doubt there are very many people out there who've read a lot of literature from Gibraltar, but by the end of today, they will have heard about Gibraltar literature.
Yes.
So, but before we turn to the texts themselves, we always start on the show with the same question, which is how does a presumably nice young person decide they want to become a specialist in Gibraltar literature, which is pretty obscure? And I assume before that you became more generally interested in Spanish and Portuguese literature. So can you tell us a little bit about what led you to your path to Davis?
Sure. I guess my interest in the Spanish language and in literature from Spain and Latin America goes back to my childhood. When I was 10 and 11, I lived with my family for a year and a half in Venezuela, in Caracas, and that's where I started learning Spanish informally, speaking with other kids at school. And then when I came back to the U.S. as a teenager, I started studying it academically. My mom also worked for about 30 years as a public school, as a high school foreign language teacher teaching Spanish and French. And I have lots of other teachers on my mom's side of the family. So I guess I kind of caught the education bug that way. And then in college, I started studying Portuguese kind of on a whim. I saw it in the course catalog at Brown, where I went to school. And I mistakenly thought that it would be easy since I already...
Yes, my husband fell into that same mistake as well, knowing Spanish and thinking he could take us around Portugal without too much effort.
Right.
It turns out it's complicated.
It is very complicated. When you look at Spanish and Portuguese on the page, they look very similar and you can kind of fake your way through it to a certain degree. But when you hear spoken Portuguese either in Portugal or in Brazil, they sound very little like Spanish, and that's the real challenge for a lot of people who speak Spanish as a native language or as a second language when they try to learn Portuguese, is the pronunciation and comprehension part.
So you started off quite early on being interested in this literature, and we always like on Office Hour to reinforce the importance of getting out of America. So I just want to reinforce again that you could go out and live for a year somewhere, and it could end up finding a language that interests you, that you'll spend then many years of your life studying that language.
That's absolutely true in my case. I grew up in a suburban town with a really little to no Spanish-speaking community to speak of, with the exception of having my mom's example as a teacher of Spanish. There wasn't really any reason for me to become interested in Latin America, and if I hadn't gone to Venezuela at that formative age, I wouldn't have gone down the professional and academic path that I did. So I really can't see myself having become the person I am now professionally without having gone on that initial trip.
Okay. So one of our mottos is go away. You know, that's one of the mottos of Office Hour. So it is just very striking to me how many people, when they're telling the story of their life, the important role that travel plays. So we've reinforced that. So then how did you become, you were picking up Portuguese already in college, I take it.
Yes.
But you've sort of gone the Portuguese and then Gibraltar. So you've kind of gone from the more mainstream Spanish to sort of looking for more different kinds of related literature.
Right. I think that when I was in college, I majored in Portuguese, and then I went to graduate school and did my master's and PhD in Portuguese. And so my focal point from 18 years on was always the Portuguese language and the Luso-Brazilian world. And so I've sort of always been interested in the relationship between Portuguese and Spanish, and looking at Spain and Latin America from the kind of semi-external reference point of either Brazil in the case of Latin America or Portugal in the case of Spain. And over time, that interest in looking at Iberian or Latin American comparisons led me very recently, really last spring, to become interested in Gibraltar, to start investigating it. And I ended up discovering the fact that it had a fascinating bilingual literary culture that in many ways my students in my upper division Spanish courses found very relevant to their own experience in terms of things like code switching and so forth.
Okay, well, before we get to Gibraltar, let's just go. So Spain, everybody's familiar with the idea of Spain in Spanish literature.
Right.
But you're adding the idea of Iberian, which is a term which I think not all of our listeners may be so familiar with. And that's the idea of going and including Portugal as well. And then you talk about the Iberian Peninsula, because it's not, everybody is not Spanish speaking.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, that's really how I understand the term. Iberian just means from the Iberian Peninsula. And I think oftentimes when we think about Europe, or when we look at the shape of the Iberian Peninsula, what we recognize there is Spain. And we think, oh, the Iberian Peninsula, that's where Spain is. Mm-hmm. And unless you have a kind of family connection to Portugal, it's not as common that you'll think of Portugal. But I think what for me is interesting about the Iberian Peninsula is the fact that on the one hand, there's this perception, at least subconsciously, that it's essentially a synonym for Spain.
Right.
But the reality is much more complicated and pluralistic.
Okay. Well, if you were going to explain to somebody then that you made this sort of broadening, what do you think Portugal adds to Spanish in order to give us a sense, so the listeners now will understand what's Iberian? You're our big opportunity to add Portugal, which I'm sure we all want to grasp onto it now. What does Portugal add?
Well, I think, first of all, depending on the period of Spanish literature that you're looking at, sometimes Portuguese literature is Spanish literature.
Okay.
There are a number of examples of medieval and early modern writers who worked across the Portuguese and Spanish languages, and who circulated between the territory that would eventually become the Spanish Kingdom and the Kingdom of Portugal. And more recently, you can find literary movements that take place at roughly the same time in both countries. Mm-hmm. And also, I think even more interestingly, examples of writers who dialogued with one another, who had personal relationships, or who read each other across these languages. And really the unique thing about those languages, when you're talking about the Iberian Peninsula, is that with the exception of Basque or Euskara, all of the other languages are forms of Ibero-Romance. So they're related to each other: Portuguese, Catalan, Spanish, Galician, etc. They form a kind of a dialect continuum, and that allows for a kind of dialogue between these places that isn't necessarily as possible when you're talking about other European countries that are adjacent to one another but whose languages aren't related.
So what we see here, what you're saying, is that they're close cousins of Spanish literature. It's like having a set of neighbors who live near you that don't speak the exact same kind of language, but with whom you are in dialogue, very close dialogue, for in fact generations.
Right. And I think the interesting complicating factor is that when you look at literary histories in general, so often when we study or even teach literature, we think of literature as something that's national.
Right.
That when you take a course in Spanish literature, you think, okay, I'm going to study the literature that was produced in this place called Spain.
Mm-hmm.
So the tendency in writing the history of literature is to think of Spanish literature and Portuguese literature as separate, just because you would teach them in separate courses. Here at Davis, Portuguese and Spanish have their own separate course categories.
Mm.
So when you sign up for a course, it's either SPA something or POR something.
Mm.
But what I try to do in my teaching is to complicate that and to show the extent to which you can do things or study things that draw on Portugal, or when you're talking about Latin America, draw on Brazil within the context of a Spanish course, and vice versa.
Okay, so right away, our listeners will never make this mistake again of just of not realizing that Iberian literature includes Portugal and
right.
Portuguese.
Yes.
And we're also, and we'll come back to this later in the show, there's a relationship with other places like Brazil. So
mm-hmm.
one of your other themes is sort of looking over borders and looking from one language system to another. And so there's a kind of, one of the themes is this idea of, as you said, code switching or multilingualism.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. I think I've always been interested in how literatures and literary systems depend on one another. That we think, like I was saying, there's a tendency often in the historiography of literature to think of the evolution of literature as something that takes place within the nation, and that a literature becomes increasingly national over time. But when you think about writers, they don't actually work that way a lot of the time. Right? We read things in translation. Writers read each other's works. If they're writing in a sort of small or minority language, they tend to become conversant in one of the world's major languages,
mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
they dialogue with literary ideas across borders. And so I've never been satisfied with that as the way that literature should be approached. I'm always looking for those external points of contact and
mm-hmm.
the ways in which even the categories that we use to study literature, like the geographical categories, like Iberia and Latin America, how those can be questioned as well.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, do you think that American literature has been, this is a little bit off the track, but we wander on office hour. Then I'm just curious, because you were so interested and have studied this idea of dialogues between different religious, with different linguistic traditions. I've wondered whether American literature has suffered in not having more dialogue partners, because most Americans don't speak other languages. And certainly when you go to Europe, you're very impressed by the way in which people speak more than one language, and as a result, read more than one type of literature, that often people would have books in many different languages and they would have access to many different ways of thinking about the world. And I've often wondered whether we don't have a sort of a reduced view because we all do only work primarily in one language.
Yeah, I think that I think that is unfortunate, and there are certainly exceptions to that rule. Obviously, I mean, American literature is a huge literary system, and there are very cosmopolitan writers who work within the United States. One of the nice things to me about the increasing multiculturalism and multilingualism of the United States is that American literature is becoming increasingly
yes.
diverse in terms of the origins of people who work within American literature, and those writers themselves problematize the sort of some of the assumptions that we make about what constitutes American literature.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even within the course of, let's say, early to mid 20th century American literature, the sort of two of the literary giants of that period are Saul Bellow, who was born in Canada,
yeah.
kind of a Jewish American writer, and Philip Roth. And so the idea, I think, from the perspective of a very sort of anti-Semitic late 19th, early 20th century United States, that the most canonical American writers of the 20th century would be Bellow and Roth, would be difficult to believe. And I think similarly, we're seeing a kind of proliferation of Latino and Chicano writers
yes.
At present, and people who have ties to various parts of the world, and it's very gratifying to see American literature move in this direction, and it fits within a broad pattern.
Absolutely, we're seeing a great deal of literature written by immigrants who bring all kinds of. If we think of the African, we've done a show on that. All of that material coming into America, and people writing in very rich traditions that they bring with them. And what we're going to do today is we are expanding American literature today, because we are expanding into American literature your translations of that you brought today. So they're now part of American literature because they translated them to English for us. So in this very show, we're going to see new input from faraway places. Before we turn to the actual poems that we're going to talk about, I do think it's important to say a little bit about Gibraltar. I just did a quick survey today and my students' eyes kind of glazed over. I think many, many people have heard of Gibraltar, but I don't think many people could very easily point to it on a map. So, and it plays a very specific and unusual role, both geographically and historically. So maybe we'll talk about that a little bit to get ourselves into the literature.
Sure. I mean, you're exactly right. When we think about the extent to which we tend to think about Gibraltar in the United States is basically as a kind of symbol. We think, oh, Gibraltar, isn't there a big rock there? Maybe it has some sort of connection with British naval history. Mm-hmm. I mean, just in a very basic sense, Gibraltar is a British overseas territory. It's located in the southern Iberian Peninsula within view of the Moroccan coast. So it's part of the region called the Strait of Gibraltar, near the confluence of the Mediterranean and the Atlantic Ocean. It's a very narrow dagger-shaped peninsula. It's about 2.5 square miles. It has a population of between 30 and 35,000. Most of the physical space of Gibraltar, which is very small, is dominated by the Rock of Gibraltar, which is about, I think, 1,400 feet tall. I know this because I ran up it when I was there. It has been a British possession since 1704, when it was taken by the British and the Dutch during the War of Spanish Succession.
Basically for military reasons.
Right. It was taken because of the strategic value of the rock itself, which, like I said, has a view of the Mediterranean. It is a view of the Moroccan coast. And over the centuries, it's been heavily fortified and has also served as a British naval base.
Right. So the Brits took it over then, and it is still today under the government of the UK.
Yes. Over the course of the 20th century, the people of Gibraltar, because in addition to a military garrison, a population of people who are now identified as Gibraltarians started coming there. And they're a marvelously eclectic group of people. They started coming there shortly after the British arrived. The British expelled the existing Spanish population and new people came in. From all over the place, from different parts of the Mediterranean. Over the course of the 20th century, they gained more and more local control over their government. And so while Gibraltar is a British overseas colony, it has its own parliament, it has its own chief minister, who would be analogous to the prime minister. It has its own local bureaucracy, flag, national symbols, sports teams, and so forth.
But it still is, interestingly enough, when a lot of other places have opted to opt out of being connected to the British rule, even in a sort of symbolic way, Gibraltar has consistently voted to stay part.
Yes.
So I think that's, again, an important part, that there isn't a heavy identification with England, and through that, through with English.
Yes, I think that one thing that a visitor to Gibraltar will notice is that the British flag flies prominently over the Rock of Gibraltar, often next to the Gibraltarian national flag. And I think that leads to the assumption that Gibraltar is a sort of bastion of pro-British feeling, which isn't exactly true. I think that while Gibraltarians have voted in two referenda to remain part of the United Kingdom, there's a great deal of strategy involved in those votes as well. The first vote took place during the dictatorship of Francisco Franco in Spain, and Gibraltarians had very little desire to become part of a dictatorial government. And since then, I think that they've seen the benefit of what might be identified as British institutions, as well as the sort of the trading advantages that come from being a kind of a free port within the British space. But this identification with the UK has certainly been called into question by Brexit. Gibraltar voted overwhelmingly for the UK to remain part of Europe. It was the constituency that voted most in favor of Remain. And things have gotten very complicated since then, because its economy depends on free trade across the border with Spain. And now that's becoming much more complicated.
Well, I think that's a very important point, and I want our listeners to understand that maybe before today they didn't even realize that Gibraltar had a Brexit problem, and now you realize that. And again, this is sort of like all the unintended consequences that come along with making a realignment like happens in Brexit. So we'll pay attention to that. In terms of literature, I think it means is that Gibraltar is a multilingual literature. And maybe that's something that's appealing to you about the literature, as you said, because Gibraltarians write in many different languages.
Yes, and the two primary languages are Spanish and English. Spanish was the most commonly spoken language in Gibraltar until really the Second World War. it was a predominantly Spanish-speaking a colony whose culture, in large part, traced its roots to the culture of Andalusia, of southern Spain, though with input from other Mediterranean cultures as well as the British Isles. And the experience of World War II, during which time the entire civilian population of Gibraltar was evacuated to London, also Northern Ireland, Jamaica, Madeira, different places, combined with the impact of the border blockade by the Franco dictatorship, subsequently after the war, led to a kind of a shift toward English, to the point where now there are people who are concerned in Gibraltar that the younger generations of Gibraltarians, while they do speak Llanito, which is a sort of a code switching or mixed form of English and Spanish that has a lot of its own particular local vocabulary, their ability to express themselves in what we could call standard Spanish. The fear is that that's disappearing and that Gibraltar is becoming increasingly English monolingual. Mm-hmm. And I spoke with people when I was in Gibraltar in March who are concerned that they're losing that part of their heritage, the part that allows them to converse in Spanish, and that through which they've been defined as their own separate people by virtue of their ability to operate in these two different tongues.
Right, and presumably that might have a big effect on the literature that's produced down there. So we're now that everybody understands Gibraltar and Gibraltarian literature, which is a term I had never heard before, and I think it's wonderful. So we're going to look at Gibraltarian literature. Can you give us an idea of sort of what is the scope and what kinds of things? Do we have everything, these 30,000 people, which is a fairly small community there, they produce the sort of the gamut in English and in Spanish of what we would think of as sort of modern literature?
I'm still really, and there are not many of us in the scholarly world who work on this topic, but there certainly has been an uptick in interest in this over the last couple of decades. But I'm still really trying to get a sense for myself of what the scope of this literary production is. There's more going on now in terms of prose writing as well as poetry, and I could list the names of some writers. Historically, there are periods in which Gibraltarian writers have been more active. The first sort of prose texts start to be published in Gibraltar in Spanish in the the early to mid 19th century. And then things continue predominantly in Spanish until the 1940s and 1950s when they shift toward English. There are still writers who write primarily or entirely in Spanish. There's a poet I'm going to read who I like very much named Trino Cruz, who is perfectly multilingual. He speaks fluent English, Spanish. I think he also speaks French and Arabic. He's a very cosmopolitan person, but his writing is entirely in Spanish, and he's a very good poet. But I would say most writers today in Gibraltar operate in English.
So, well, we will start then, and we will look at our first example of a Gibraltarian poet. So, who do you want to read first?
I think I'll start with Trino Cruz.
Okay.
And I'll read the beginning of a poem that he wrote that was published in a book called Rila in 2003. In Spanish, it's called El Vértigo del Polizón, Apuntes para un Autorretrato, or in English, The Stowaway's Vertigo, Notes for a Self-Portrait. I'll read maybe the first couple of verses in Spanish and then switch over to the English translation.
So this is a very contemporary poet.
Yes, he's still writing today. He and a team of Gibraltarian writers actually, I think on May 31st, published an anthology of Gibraltar, of contemporary Gibraltar poets, in which he features along with some other people.
Okay, so we're going to hear a little bit of it in the original language, and then you'll read it to us, for those of us who need help, you'll read it to us in English in the full form.
Okay, so this is just the beginning of the poem in Spanish, and then I'll read the entire poem in English translation. El vértigo del polizón, apuntes para un autorretrato. Una música deshaciéndose en jirones, sombras que escarban, que se persiguen a sí mismas hasta anonadarse en ti. Una cascada que rompe con el tiempo, fuga de memoria. And then in English. A song, the stowaway's vertigo. A song tearing itself to pieces. Shadows that dig at, that consume themselves until they become nothing. In you. A waterfall that breaks from the flow of time. Memory escaping. A darkness full of beings that don't recognize you, that you don't recognize. A god coming apart in bursts of music. You, skillfully hidden behind a quicksilver mask, with the abrupt and dry breaths of a dying centaur. Your voice becomes fixed, a false trace in the back of my mouth, the sea drying up in my eyes and in yours, the wanderer's path is lost. My features are yours. Your soul drags me toward a den peopled by shadows, beings that fall back on themselves and devour themselves in the water's confused transparency.
Thank you. That's a beautiful poem, as well as introducing me to an entire new national, dare we say, genre of literature that I've never heard before. So tell me, what is it about the stowaway's vertigo that particularly drew you to this poem and this poet?
I think that, you know, his poetry in a way is difficult to work with because I'm really, in my research on literature from Gibraltar, I'm looking to see how this literature comments on Gibraltar's situation, mm-hmm. vis-a-vis Spain, the United Kingdom, the Mediterranean. But Trino's poetry is much more enigmatic than that. He operates with a kind of a set of symbols, a kind of a symbolic repertoire with references to mirrors, with references to flowing water, to things that fall back on themselves. And he reconfigures these symbols throughout his work. But I think you do detect here an engagement with the Mediterranean, particularly in the figure of the polisson, the stowaway. I haven't asked him about this, but this seems like a reference to people who have attempted to cross the Strait of Gibraltar in boats and on rafts, many of whom end up in very dangerous situations and die. This could be something that responds to that Mediterranean crossing. And I think that he's someone who's very aware of the fact that Gibraltar is in constant dialogue with Morocco. His grandparents lived in Tangier, and when I met with him in March, he was actually going to leave the next day to Tangier. He and his family are trying to sell his grandparents' house there. So he's constantly thinking about the way that Gibraltar, while it's part of the Iberian Peninsula and also part of the kind of the transnational British space, it's also a Mediterranean territory that has quite a bit in common with communities on the other side of the strait.
Things like the sea drying up. So you have sea, a lot of water images. You also have, with the dying centaur, you also have references to mythological traditions.
Yeah.
So he's bringing in mythological traditions there. A quicksilver mask, in other words, all of the kinds of ways in which something is interposed between one person and another, a den peopled by shadows. So there's quite a bit of darkness, I think, in this poem as well. Literally, darkness full of beings that don't betray you, that you don't recognize, a den peopled by shadows. So there seems to be a lot of references to sort of partial presences.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether these are the dead, whether these are the poets of the past, or maybe combinations of many of these.
Yeah, I think you brought up the sort of the mythological level that this poem might operate in. And if you think about it that way, this could be a reference to the idea of the underworld, a world populated by shadows. And that's a part of the Gibraltarian tradition too, because Gibraltar is known as one of the two pillars of Hercules. And so it's a landscape that has seen itself be a site for mythology. But in a much more topical way, when you think about many of the people who make that Mediterranean crossing to places like Gibraltar, to Lampedusa, to Greece and so forth from North Africa or the Middle East, they arrive in shadow, both in terms of their legal status and often under the cover of night. And so I think that it's a poem that can be read on those two levels, is something that's a very real situation that many migrants deal with, but also trying to lend a sort of a dignity and also historical contextualization to to this bit of contemporary life.
They're the latest addition to the wanderers that go back, obviously, all the way back through Greek literature as well.
Right.
They're the latest wanderers of a line of many wanderers. Well, we have reached the end of our first half of Office Hour today, so we're going to take a short break, and then we will come back and talk some more and read some more poetry to get us all ready for finals week for next week. So stay tuned. So welcome back. This is the second half of Office Hour today. This is Professor Jay, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz. And today we are very happy to have Robert Newcomb from Spanish and Portuguese, who is reading to us some of his original translations of Gibraltarian literature, which I'm sure many of us had never read any Gibraltarian literature. Though I did note that you have listed here, if our listeners enjoy this, there is a book called The Anthology of Contemporary Gibraltar Poets that was just published. So people can, in fact, go out and you know, impress people that they have a book of poetry from Gibraltar.
Yeah, it was listed for publication on the 31st. I haven't gotten my copy yet. I think it'll be a while yet, but it's an exciting project. It attempts to really capture a lot of the contemporary writing that's happening in Gibraltar. I met with a number of the editors when I was there. They got well over 100 submissions from folks in Gibraltar. Mm-hmm. And there's some really high quality work that is featured in that, not only by Trino Cruz, but also another poet that I want to read today, named Marisa Salazar.
Okay, so this is our second Gibraltar poet. So tell us a little bit about this one.
Unfortunately, I don't know much about her myself. I didn't get the opportunity to meet her while I was there, but I was impressed by an untitled poem from the anthology. I got to see the poems in advance because I was asked to write one of the forewords for the anthology, and so I got to see the manuscript, and I really liked a poem that she wrote about the border, the land border between Gibraltar and Spain, which is a short one. This is not my original translation since it was written in English, but I can just read it to you if you'd like.
Absolutely.
Okay. So here it is. This is an untitled poem, and it starts like this. Frontier flags billow, symbols divide, birds fly across unaware. Two-track queue, other moves faster. Waving, hissing attention, palm trees. Even they, unshaven, keep sentry line on barbed wire, blackbird, colorful song.
Great. And that does help us address, or she addresses much more directly than the last poet we talked about. This is Marisa Salazar from the Anthology of Contemporary Gibraltar Poets, which, as we just learned, doesn't exist yet, but is going to exist very soon. It does much more directly deal with the question of frontier. That's the first word, frontier.
Yes.
So it places us in this place about which, as you said, is so tiny that the frontier is everywhere. I presume you could probably see it from anywhere.
Right. There's one land border with Spain, but when you're in Gibraltar, depending on where you are, and if you go to the top of the Rock of Gibraltar, you can see Algeciras and La Línea de la Concepción, which are two Spanish cities that are more or less adjacent to Gibraltar. You can see how Gibraltar is situated with regard to the Spanish coast as well as Morocco. And so it's small enough that Spain is always in view, but depending on the period of history you're talking about, Gibraltarians have had more or less access to Spain. And now the fear is that with Brexit, it will become more complicated to cross the border, to see family, to see friends, to do things like shopping.
Exactly, shopping, yeah.
All of these things that we tend to think about here in California as a function of our own culture on the border between California and Mexico, or between Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But what I like about this poem is that she shows the disparity that we often note with borders between the artificially imposed political border marked by frontier flags that say that everything south of this line is Gibraltar and everything north of this line is Spain. But birds in the natural world doesn't really respect, they don't really respect these these artificially imposed borders. The birds here fly across unaware. Yes. They don't really care that there's a that these two lines, or as the poet says, queues of cars have to wait perhaps hours just to cross the border, depending on how bad the traffic is.
But so far, there are no bird queues at this point.
Nope.
Birds just, they haven't put that in there yet. So do you think that this is particularly related? I want to go back to the imagery again, but first, just to situate it. Do you think this is really a Brexit poem as well, or do you think it's just a frontier poem? Because there's always a frontier there. It's just, as you say, I think we're not always aware when we're reading the news in Europe that with Brexit, there would be a more active physical kind of the boundary would become more important, presumably.
Right. And there's a border regardless,
right.
That you have to cross, and it can take quite a while depending on traffic. There is a lot of discussion in Gibraltar about how when things are not going so well with Spain, the border tends to slow down quite a bit. but the border would become harder under Brexit, presumably. And that's really the fear. Though it's also something that Gibraltarians are familiar with from the years of the closed border, really the over 2-decade period in which, in order to get to Spain, Gibraltarians had to take a ferry to Morocco and then take another ferry from Morocco across the ocean back to Spain, and it would take all day.
Wow. Well, and what 2 decades were those?
Let's see. I'm going to probably get the exact dates wrong, but I think this was between 1969 and it was partially opened in 82 and I think definitively opened in 85.
Right.
And my Gibraltarian friends can correct me on this.
Well, it's close enough. It gives us an idea that then when all, you know, after the new agreements of making it easier to go back and forth, it also affected the place. And imagine for a place like Gibraltar being so small. We're talking 2.5 miles.
Yes, it's, I mean, the population is half the population of Davis, to give you an idea. It looks much more urban than Davis because it is so physically compressed and there's a lot of construction going on. Even now, a lot of money is flowing into Gibraltar as a port, as a site for offshore finance. So it looks like in parts, it looks like a real city, but its actual local resident population is very small.
Very small. So if we go back to the poem then, it says, two track queue, other moves faster. Does that mean people who have a passport that says other on it? I've been traveling in Europe where there are different kinds of lines. And it is quite striking that sometimes there'll be a line for one group and a line for the other group. And someone will have 10 different, you know, officials there moving everybody through very slowly. And the other passport group, the line may be longer or shorter, but the wait may be much different. I don't know whether that's part of what's going on in that stanza. It's not totally clear to me.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, the couple of times I crossed the border from Gibraltar back into Spain, there was one line, though you do have the option of crossing it on foot or driving across. So I don't know if that's a reference to different sort of ways to cross the land border or if it's a reference to the distinction between the way that animals or features of the natural world, like birds, can cross the border as opposed to human beings who are forced to respect this kind of political or security process.
Right, because we have a series of natural images in the poem.
Right.
We have palm trees. They don't go back and forth, but they keep the sentry line. They're sort of like that. And then we have the blackbird, which is singing its song, which presumably also songs don't obey the borders either.
Right, and I think that one thing this poem is trying to do, and also something that I see in Trino Cruz's poetry, is that it's trying to illustrate the continuities that cross borders, that there are political barriers that in some ways are hard and in some ways are not so hard, depending on the circumstances. Those political barriers may serve to divide people, but I think that both of these poets, in these instances at least, are concerned with showing the degree to which, regardless of this fraught political history, Gibraltar is a place that shares a great deal culturally in
yes.
terms of its landscape and language with southern Spain, but mm-hmm. also with northern Morocco, with other parts of the Mediterranean that Gibraltarians have come from, like Menorca, Malta,
because these
Portugal,
birds,
so
the birds
forth.
Fly all over the place.
Right.
So, exactly. Well, I'm curious then, what would you say about the fact that the poem is written in English?
I mean, I think that it's typical of the fact that most literature that's produced in Gibraltar nowadays tends to be written in English. Mm. I think that's reflective of the shift toward English that's taken place, really from the mid-20th century forward in Gibraltar. You know, the in the anthology itself, there is poetry in Spanish contributed by writers like Trino, as well as Humbert Hernandez, who writes primarily in Spanish, though also writes in English, Spanish being his first language. But the majority of contemporary literature does tend to be written in English. Mm-hmm. And really one of the striking things I think about being in Gibraltar is that when you're there, you see that everything in terms of signage and official documents is all in English. And so that leads to a kind of assumption that it's an English-speaking space. But then when you actually hear people speaking to one another, you can hear a great deal of switching back and forth between English and Spanish.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So there's this kind of dichotomy there between the official language and then the language of the home, which in many cases leans more toward Spanish.
Okay. So the first one was a Spanish. Trino mm-hmm. Cruz was
right.
was written in Spanish, and you translated that.
Yeah.
This one is someone who writes in English, presumably,
yes.
So you didn't have to translate that. Marisa Salazar. So who is the poet that you want to read to us?
I wanted to read another poet that I like quite a bit. This is a mid-20th century poet, Joseph Patrón. I don't know exactly when this poem was written. It was from a book that I found at the Garrison Library, which is Gibraltar's main research library. This book collects poems that he wrote between 1940 and 1950. And he has a poem divided into two parts called Gibraltar, which I like just because it offers a very nice visual representation of Gibraltar, particularly the kind of the color scheme of the place, as well as the lights, the way the light sort of shines off the rock. So I wanted to read the first half of this poem for the audience.
Now, the name of the poem is Gibraltar.
Right. It's just called Gibraltar.
Exactly. So you're really locating us deeply within Gibraltarian literature. But what is the name of the book? Do you know what the name of the book was?
It's just called it's called Poems 1940.
It's just called Poems 1940 1950. Okay.
And in fact, you know, I don't know anything really about the circumstances of its publication. I don't know if it was published by Patrón himself. There were some volumes that were published by the Garrison Library at various at various points. Really, there's been a real problem of publication in Gibraltar because it is so small and because it's so hard to publish your own materials there. Even a writer as prominent as the novelist Mark Sanchez, who's probably the best known contemporary Gibraltarian prose writer, self-publishes his work. He lives in the UK, and as he explained to me, he's found it very difficult to get British presses, even if they're interested in his work stylistically, to get them to publish it, just because he is dedicated to situating his work in Gibraltar. Mm-hmm. And that's not considered really marketable because of how small it is.
Right. Well, so here we're going to find, in the 1940s, presumably, poems 40, 50, here's someone who's trying to explain to themselves what is Gibraltar.
Right. And really, that's, I think, one of the first tasks of any sort of emergent national literature is to try to explain its own space to the world. And so that's one of the reasons I wanted to read this.
Okay. So this is Joseph Patrón telling us what about his homeland.
Okay, so here we go. We suspected nothing. The warm airs that sauntered later in the afternoon, like well-behaved, incurious children, in the heated gardens were devoid of rumors. Under the sun, in a white void, the sounds of voices reached a climax and then strayed, at dusk, into a silence like a nurse, bent over knitting just beyond the bed. But now, as under an almost round moon, the sea unravels its sleeves and reaches out for your still unripe form. And from the bay, you gleam a paler shade than the pale sky. We long to touch the unbelieving hands, the dreamless rock you seemed in the bright day.
Okay, well, it's a poem about called Gibraltar, and it does have a rock.
Yes, it does.
It does have a prominent rock there in that line. It's called a dreamless rock. So what sense of that are you going to make for us? You know,
it's hard to say. I mean, it's a nice image. I think that in one way, you could interpret dreamlessness as referring to the rock steadiness and the idea of the Rock of Gibraltar as a solid monolithic presence is very much a part of the Gibraltar tradition.
Mm-hmm.
The idea here is that the rock is dreamless by virtue of the fact that it's not alive, but that paradoxically grants it a kind of permanence. It doesn't dream. It's not a human being. And that, in a sense, is reassuring because it's so monolithic and huge that it gives to people who see it the idea of steadiness that it will always be there.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the poem also seems concerned with the play of light and shadow against this natural landscape. And so in the last line where he talks about the dreamless rock you seemed in the bright day, he's referring at least obliquely to the fact that the rock looks different in during the night as opposed to what it looked like during the day, that the play of light on the rock creates a certain impression during the daytime. It's a very sunny Mediterranean place, though the rock is so large it also makes its own weather, and it can be covered in clouds as well. But it's so large, it's visible from anywhere you are in Gibraltar. So I think it works best as a sort of visual poem, a visual representation of the rock.
Mm-hmm. And our desire, because there's also, we long to touch the unbelieving hands, the dreamless rock you seemed in the bright day. So there's something very intimate about this rock, even though it's rock, it's very intimate.
Yeah, I think that, you see this in, as makes a lot of sense in other writing by people from Gibraltar, that the rock, as much as it's a symbol for the British armed forces of military glory, is also a symbol for the Gibraltarian people of their homeland. And so it retains a great deal of symbolic importance for them, too. It becomes a kind of signifier of their homeland and their community, that when they're in proximity to the rock, they're by definition almost in proximity to Gibraltar, the city, or Gibraltar, the community.
Mm-hmm. I wonder also, to contradict myself, which is often what we do when we read poetry, right? If we have one idea and then we have another one. It's only, the rock is only dreamless during the bright day.
Mm-hmm.
So it's possible that there's a kind of a transformational idea here, that the rock also, just like us, goes through some kind of a transformation. The sun goes down and we turn into all the crazy things that we turn into in our dreams. Presumably the rock doesn't actually change, but maybe it becomes a mythic figure itself at night when everybody's sleeping. And that's what's part of living in Gibraltar is. You're living on top of this gigantic mythic thing that's pretty steady during the day, but maybe not when you go to sleep.
Right. And in fact, that's what he does in the second part of the poem. Which sort of begins like this: a tidal darkness overswept the shore, and landscapes that had fed the accustomed eye convulsed and crumbled till the metal jaws of dinosauri yawned to prophecy, the end of their prehistory. And so he sort of shows that, like you were saying, what looks a certain way during the daytime that appears steady and solid turns into something maybe more mysterious or even nefarious at night. So it does seem to be a poem that's bifurcated on the basis of the kind of the time of day, which corresponds to the play of light and darkness against this place.
So then what does Gibraltar mean then? Does it mean that it's a country that, like us, is both inanimate and yet animate at different times? What can we step away from saying, what is the national identity here? I don't know.
Yeah, that's very tricky. I would have to know much more about this poem and about this poet to be able to have a sense for what he was projecting onto the Rock of Gibraltar in this case. But what I think is significant here is that this is one of the significant aspects is that this is the product of someone who was himself from Gibraltar, and that really a good deal of Gibraltarian literature has, I think, been concerned with getting the opportunity to speak on behalf of itself and on behalf of the Gibraltarian community, and to sort of wrest away part of the narrative of Gibraltar from the military tradition
right.
of Gibraltar's connection to the Battle of Trafalgar or World War II and so forth, and be able to describe the environment, the built environment and the natural environment from the perspective of the civilian population that, that lives there and that has lived there for the past 300 years. And, you know, the Rock of Gibraltar is such a prominent feature of that space that it that's really, it seems like that's the first sort of stop along the way in reconfiguring some of the symbolic vocabulary of the Rock of Gibraltar from the perspective of the people who live there.
I think that's a very important point. So I just want to reiterate it, that, you know, if you live in a tiny 2.5 square mile country that plays prominent role in British military history, your history might be subsumed into British history. And this is not a poem about the military role of the Rock. So as you say, what we see here is a poet trying to, you know, get the Rock out from underneath how it's viewed and give us another view of it that is their view. And it's not going to be one around British history. It's around their local history and what it does. And the part of it is their natural landscape. Because, again, there's a lot of natural imagery in here as well. And this is what it is. It's our natural landscape. It's our country. It's our land. It's what we live on. It's how we experience time through living on this rock, which I think often seems to be something sort of timeless, you know?
Yeah, I think that really one of the things that I'm most interested in studying literature from Gibraltar is exactly that point that you were just making, that one of the projects of Gibraltarian literature is in trying, seems to lie in how Gibraltarians want to situate their homeland.
Right.
Whether as a part of the Commonwealth, whether as a state or city-state, nation, micronation, what have you, that's a part of a kind of a trans-Mediterranean space, whether as part of the Iberian Peninsula, albeit politically independent from Spain. I think that's really one of the things that writers from Gibraltar have been concerned with over the decades, is to sort of get the right to tell their own stories, essentially. Mm-hmm. The novelist Mark Sanchez wrote in an op-ed that a lot of his project is focused on giving Gibraltar, as he put it, our own representative voice, precisely mm-hmm. because Gibraltar and its history have been so overdetermined by the way that Gibraltar is viewed from the perspective either of the UK or the perspective of Spain.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a powerful idea. This is a place, as you said, that's half the size of Davis, mm-hmm. is going to branch out and have its own national literature, its own view of itself. It's going to get out from underneath the Brits, even if it votes to stay part of the British government generally. And it does it through literary traditions. So I think that's something very powerful. It says something very powerful about the role of literature in giving people an idea of how they imagine the place that they live, new ways of imagining the place that they live in.
Absolutely. It's very powerful to be able to tell your own story. And mm-hmm. I think that, you know, if I could kind of shift toward the way that I've taught this a little bit at Davis, this is one of the ways that I think this literature has appealed to some of my students, with the comparison that many of them have made on their own between literature from Gibraltar and Chicano or Latino literature mm-hmm, in the United
mm-hmm,
States,
mm-hmm.
In terms of the struggle to tell your own story, the crafting of an identity that draws on two language traditions and code switching between them.
Mm-hmm.
That's been one of the real pleasures, I think, of really falling into this research topic is its strange relevance.
Okay.
Well,
that's great. And maybe we can end then, because we're nearing the end now, is what advice do you give people who are trying to tell their own narrative? What have you learned from the study that you've done, for if somebody wants to? Any group of 30,000 people can now launch themselves off and develop their own quote-unquote national literature to tell their own story. Any advice you have on how to go about doing that?
I think one thing I would say is that, well, certainly everyone has the right to tell their own story. Often the quest to tell your own story involves a kind of evasion of the degree to which you're actually part of a broader community and tied to other groups and other peoples. And I think that's a real mistake. That's the dark side of literatures and cultures in formation.
Mm-hmm.
We think of ourselves as very different and disconnected from people we define as others, and mm-hmm. And that's very dangerous. And I would hope that that wouldn't happen with any group that's trying to bring its own literature into being.
So the end then is to tell your own story. But as you started off at the beginning, look over the fence, share your literature with the other people in the next place, exchange multilingual poetry with them, grow beyond your own tradition as well.
Right. I think that's absolutely the case. Operating across languages doesn't mean that you want to become part of the country next door to you.
But
that's kind of a false assumption.
It's just a way of enriching your own literary tradition.
Yes,
exactly.
Yeah.
Well, terrific. I want to thank Robert Newcomb very much for coming on the show today. And
thank you.
Yeah. And the show will be archived on officehourucdpodcast.com, like all of our shows. Next week, we're going to knock on a completely different door. But I encourage everybody at Davis, as we move through finals week, to get out those books of poetry and read yourself, read your tense roommate, get your parents to read you some poems on the phone at night, whatever you can do to help us through the next while. And meantime, we'll be back next week. But meanwhile, stay tuned for Radio Theater, which is coming up next. And we'll see you next week. Bye.